struck me again that there's two ways to read this text. One would be in isolation. And, you know, with all narrative texts, it could be subject to any manner of interpretation. The other, of course, is in its setting, in its context, which, of course, is always the proper way to go. And I even had a sermon theme popped into my head, something like the goal of glory. I mean, you get a couple of "g" in there, you know, and then the people think you're a rhetorical genius. And if they think that once every 6 or 7 months, then you're in good shape. But the context, you know, is St. Peter's confession and then Jesus' prediction of his suffering and death in verse 22, and then Jesus' strong call to discipleship, self-denial, etc. So that, you know, and then, by the way, in chapter 9, after the transfiguration, then very soon afterwards comes the so-called travel narrative, where Jesus begins to travel towards Jerusalem, the place of his, we'll get to it in a minute, Exodus. Okay, so that this glory is, you know, it reveals something about Jesus. I mean, this is a this is both a simple and a profound thing to say. The transfiguration chiefly tells us something about Jesus, but the context in which the transfiguration occurs tells us even more about this, you know, glorious divine figure. The interpretation and preaching of the text has to take that into account. So that it's not just show for show's sake, but it offers a marvelous contrast. And it reminds me, you know, theologically, of course, of something like Philippians 2. That is, although he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God something to be grasped, but emptied himself and journeyed, Lucan terminology now, to the cross for our sake. So there's a wonderful opportunity to preach that. And you could even make this application precisely because it follows Jesus' teaching on discipleship, is that in our lives, then, there is glory and promise, and yet until the day of our exodus, I suppose you can perhaps make that application, there's no guarantee of success and fulfillment, but we live under the cross and walk in the light that it gives. So anyway, all that kind of stuff, you know, you could really do a great job homiletically to hold forth the power and wonder of Christ, who takes his power and wonder, goes to the cross, calls us to follow him, and enables us so to do. We pick up at verse 28, and the first thing I want to say about this text is it reads like the Septuagint. I mean, it's got all these chi agenitas in there. I mean, it's a very Semitic, Luke does this a lot anyway, but it's a very Semitic sort of style, which fits nicely in picking up, you know, Moses and Elijah and the Old Testament fulfillment theme. So let's just kind of read through verse 28. Agenita de meta tus logus tutus, hose hemerai ucto. Now we have, and you can do it literally, and it came to pass after these words about discipleship in 23 to 27, and who he really is earlier on, about 8 days, you can always remember octo because of octagon. If you can remember what an octagon is, you can remember that octo means eight. About 8 days, Matthew and Mark give us 6, a little more precise. And it came to pass, paralabon, from paralambano, taking along, he took along Peter and James and John, and he went up into the mountain to pray. Now, it's into the mountain. I'm not sure what to make of that. I don't necessarily think I want to make too much. Although we do get Moses. See, I don't know. The definite article after prepositions is a dicey thing in Greek. Sometimes it's there. Now you see it, now you don't. So I'm not sure. It might be a Bible class comment. Is Luke intending us to recall the mountain where Moses died? I don't know. Couldn't prove it grammatically. I'll just say it that way. So leave it out of the sermon. He went up into the mountain to pray. Verse 29, and once again, chi agenita. Now we have, and it came to pass, en to pros euchestai. Luke likes en to plus the infinitive. It almost always is translated temporally, while or when. So when auton he was praying, ta eidos, the appearance of the face of him, other. You have to supply a verb, was or became other, and the clothing of him, have to supply a verb. In fact, I didn't even check out the variant, but I'm assuming that's what the variant reading is trying to do. Give us a verb. Yeah, right. Became. So we can do that on our own. Became white, gleaming. So Jesus is, you know, the phrase transfigured. Verse 30. And look, two guys began to talk with him, since the appearance, you could translate it inceptively, the imperfect, began to talk with him, who were Moses and Elijah. I always wondered, how did they know, right? Little, you know, hello, my name is Moses, right? It's kind of like when the Philippian guy says, come over to Macedonia and help us. You know, so hi, Macedonian Chamber of Commerce. Anyway, Moses, apparently it was obvious. So Moses, whose death is mysterious, right? And Elijah, who doesn't die at all, right? Now, who are these guys? I tend to think that the traditional answer is probably right. That is, what we have here is the law and the prophets. We have the Old Testament revelation, and Luke has this theme. You know, it's expressed in Luke a number of places, and not the least in chapter 24 at the end of the gospel, where everything written in there, sometimes it's even the tripartite division of the law, the prophets, and the writings, right, is fulfilled in Christ. And so I think that's probably right. We have Old Testament revelation pointing forward to Christ, and now we have that revelation, in a sense, personified, right? So Moses and Elijah, who, verse 31, being seen in glory, or appearing in glory, elegon, were talking, or were discussing, I suppose you have a direct object, the exodus of him, which he was fixin' to, that's one way to translate mellow, it means to be about to do something, who was which he was fixin' to fulfill in Jerusalem. Okay? Exodus is kind of an obvious term, and once again, the traditional view, I think, is probably right, that we've got an Israel-Jesus typology going on here. That the great deed of salvation, right, in the Old Testament, whereby God formed a people for himself, is the Exodus. You know, even greater, now in fulfillment of all of God's words and Old Testament deeds, will be the great deed of salvation that Jesus will accomplish in Jerusalem. Probably not just his death, probably not just his resurrection, but the whole complex of death, resurrection, and also ascension. So, and now what was this conversation like? You know, Moses and Elijah are discussing, you know, what did they say? Did they say things like, you know, we've been looking forward to this for a long time. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, they were discussing Jesus' great act of deliverance, right? Which he was about to fulfill, Old Testament fulfillment, right, in Jerusalem. And, verse 32, and the Peter and the with him guys were, now here's actually a translational ambiguity. We have first of all, we have a periphrastic form, eison is the imperfect of ami, and then the perfect participle from bareo, which means to weigh down or be heavy. So, Peter and those with him had been, we'll give it a perfect, pluperfect translation, had been weighed down, hypno, with sleep. So, now, did they fall asleep all the way and then wake up, or did they manage to stay awake? That hinges on how you translate diagregoreo. Now, diagregoreo can mean either to stay awake or to become fully awake. See? Now, if you translate it to mean they stayed awake, then you'd go like this. Peter and those with him had been weighed down with sleep, but because they had stayed awake, they saw his glory and the two men who were standing with him. Okay? Or, lexically, if you take the verb to mean to become fully awake, you could translate it temporally, perhaps. And when they had become fully awake, they saw. It's actually an ambiguity, and the commentaries make reference to it. The point is the same in either case, that Luke wants the reader to be absolutely certain that this is not a dream, right? The extent to which they were weighed down with sleep is uncertain, but the fact that they were no longer weighed down with sleep is made clear no matter how you translate that particular participle. So I'm actually drawn towards perhaps the sense of staying awake. It seems to be a little more strongly attested in the lexica. So we'll translate it that way. So they got sleepy, fair enough. But since they stayed awake, they didn't sleep through the whole thing, which raises the question, could you have slept through the transfiguration? Well, in my younger days, yes. But not since turning 40 some years ago. Since they stayed awake, they saw his glory and the two men who were standing with him. From synistimi, and that's a perfect participle, has a present intransitive meaning. Look it up in Veltz chapter or whatever. 33, and here's another chiagena construction. And it came to pass that while they were departing from him, ento diachorizes thy autus. The autus, I suppose, has to be Moses and Elijah. So they're on their way out. Peter said to the Jesus, Master. Here's our word that we had a couple of weeks ago, and I actually wrote the passages down this time. Whenever Jesus gets called Master, it becomes clear, again, that the person who calls him this doesn't really know what he's talking about. Okay, and here is another good example of this. Master, because St. Luke tells us, kalanestes hemas hoda enai. For us to be here is good. Okay, so the infinitive construction is the subject of estin. For us to be here is good. And, I suppose this would be a hortatory subjunctive. Let us make three tents, mian soi, one for you, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Now Luke interrupts, me eidos ha lege, not knowing what he was saying. Just in case the reader wasn't clear, the evangelist tells us that this is a great doofus moment for the apostle St. Peter, right? Now, you know, 'tis good, Lord, to be here, but we may not remain. Da 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 da, go with us to the plain, right? Garth Brooks sings great Lutheran hymns. What is Peter after here? We don't know, but the only thing we do know is he doesn't get it, okay? And in light of the journey, right, in light of the Exodus, which he was fixing to fulfill, but he hadn't fulfilled yet, right? There's something wrong. Peter wants to prolong, protract, you know, embrace this glory. He wants the glory, but he doesn't want to get it in the way that it can be gotten. All right, verse 34. While he was saying these things, excuse me, genitive absolute, a nephele agenitut, a cloud happened. Uh-oh, Yahweh the cloud rider, God is showing up here, right? The Father is making his appearance. And it was overshadowing them. This is the same verb as when the Holy Ghost is going to overshadow Mary in Luke 1. Okay, this is, I mean, God is here, right? And they react accordingly. Ephobetheson. They were afraid. Ento eis elthein autus. As they were entering into the cloud. So, I mean, it's really quite vivid. They're on this mountain, wherever it is, and this cloud, you know, starts moving towards them, and it's kind of like, you know, the closer it gets, the fear index goes up, right? Which, again, is the way humans always react in the presence of holiness. Verse 35, and a voice happened from the cloud saying, this is my son, the eklegomide one. Eklegomai means to choose. This is the perfect participle passive. The one having been chosen, autu akuata. Often the person you're supposed to hear is in the genitive after akuo, so hear him. And while the voice was happening, Jesus was found, the aorist indicative passive from Herisco, Jesus was found only. And they were silent. And to no one they announced in those days nothing, hon hel rakon, of the things they had seen. That's a great way to end the story because it tells you that it's not complete, right? It's not complete. The goal of the glory, right? So that really it's a wonderful opportunity to proclaim the identity, excuse me, of Jesus, and also the mission of Jesus at the same time, because it's not yet time for it to be proclaimed, and it wasn't even time for Peter to understand it, right? Because he didn't yet know that Jesus, he didn't yet understand that even though Jesus has said it, that he is setting his face you know, King James, like flint towards Jerusalem in order to accomplish the great exodus there. So there's opportunity to preach the law, right? You know, this theologian of glory in all of us. There's wonderful opportunity to preach the gospel. And also, if you wanted to make an application to discipleship, you know, this is the road that the Christ follows, and those who are his are also called to follow that same path. So, and again, very Semitic and Old Testament-y in its style. Questions, comments? Yeah, Don.
Why is Elijah the representative of the prophets?
Maybe because of the Malachi passage, right? You know, before the great and terrible day of the Lord, I will send Elijah the prophet. It's a good question. That's the only guess I have. Yeah, good. Because that figures prominently, I can't sum it up Luke, but it's very prominent in Matthew, I know, that John the Baptist, in fact, is Elijah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, we're reading on level two, are we not? Yeah, to use what's-his-name's terms. Yeah, well, really, yeah, it's a good question. I think you're on safe ground because we've got pleroo, right? On safe ground to do the looking forward fulfillment thing. Now, in Bible class, you really might, you know, offer to people. Here's a couple of different possible ways of looking at this. Yeah, good question.